Greetings. Welcome to Confessing the Blues. I'm your host, Jim Ange Anderson. On today's show, we feature from Detroit, Michigan, Laura Rain and the Caesars. Let's roll. George Friend, welcome to the Farmhouse Studios.
Why, thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
And you had a good trip. You guys came up from Indianapolis?
Yeah. Yeah, we drove up to 65, and it's a beautiful day. We're glad to be here.
Great. So let's talk about, you have a brand new record. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about Walk With Me?
Yeah. This is our fourth album mm-hmm. of all original, Detroit-based soul and R&B blues. And we had every record we try to push ourselves a little bit further, you know. So there's a lot of different kind of songs on it. And we're really happy. It just came out a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
It almost took it out of me. It was a lot of work, this record.
It was a labor of love.
It was, for sure. I mean, usually when we start writing a record, and we'll write like 20 songs, and it takes, you know, 2, 3, 4 months, and then the next step is we demo everything, and we work on the arrangements extensively before we record with the band, you know. So By the time we started recording, we had been writing and doing the demos for months. And when, you know, every time you do a record, you learn something.
Sure.
You know, you waste money, or you have too many people at the session. You always learn something.
Not enough people at the session.
Not enough people. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So with this record, by the time we recorded, we had learned a lot of different things about how to approach the recording, how many songs we were going to do in one day. You know, a lot of bands will go to a really nice studio and record, you know, 8 songs
as quick as possible.
Sure, yeah. To save money.
We've done that too.
Yeah, we've done both ways. We've recorded at home in the living room,
right?
And you get a certain result that way, yeah. And it's fun. It's always fun. But this this was our second record that we did at a different studio called Magnetic in Pontiac, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And all analog tape, 2-inch Ampex MM1200 machine, which is a fat, huge sound. And he has a really huge, large room, high ceilings. So you can play live, no headphones. And
it's like performing.
It's, yeah.
It's live.
And you're on a stage and everything. So we decided we would do that, and not only do that, but do it while we videotaped the first session. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those videos are on YouTube. There's like 4 songs on there. And what you're hearing, and when you see the video, is essentially the recording, you know, about 95% of it. We did, you know, after we did this session, we did some overdubs,
sure,
here and there, percussion, things like that.
But I think a lot of the music that we enjoy and that we kind of grew up with was recorded that way. It was recorded live and wasn't, you know, somebody on the East Coast and somebody on the West Coast,
right,
and somebody shows up later. I mean, it's a band in a room.
Right, for sure. And particularly in the style of music that we write and record, that's really important to us.
Right.
To do even live vocals, you know, which, you know, a lot of people do not do that these days.
Right.
But all the records that we like, yeah, you're right, were recorded that way.
So, Laura, we have a special visitor with us in the studio. And George had said how this was very difficult for him. Well, you had a baby during the making of this record, right? Can you talk about that whole thing?
Well, we were on tour. We toured up until 8.5 months. And I think the last vocals I did was just, I think, over 9 months. I did the final overdubs, and then the photo shoot for the album was 9.5 months. That's why the album cover is legs and heads.
Right.
It turned out great, but you know, it's always a chuckle when I explain. And then the backside, there's a bunch of 45s covering me, and you know, I was on the ground, and I really couldn't get up off the floor in the photo studio. It was kind of funny, but it was a struggle emotionally, all of the above. This record, we put everything and then some into, and I think it shows.
There's a certain, I don't know, magic about a pregnant woman, and there's just the essence of a woman carrying a child. I mean, being in that state while you're recording, did it bring something to the recording?
Well, I think that the entirety of my pregnancy, there was an unrefined creativity that was just like an extra bonus to being pregnant. And even before I knew I was pregnant, so we wrote all the songs, most of them while I was pregnant. Some of them we had written previously and then returned to them.
Right.
So the songwriting, you know, reflects a certain essence that it was unique at the time.
Can you talk about the process? I mean, is it a 50-50 or is it music, lyrics? I mean, how do you guys collaborate on your songwriting?
Every song is different. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I come up with the melody and the words and the basic lyrical theme to the song. Sometimes George composes a song and then I write to what he composes. Sometimes it's almost like automatic writing. We just start singing and playing and we hit the record button and the song is basically formed at that point.
Sure.
Sometimes I just sing and sing and sing and then George pieces different things together and we make sense of something that I rambled out. So it's all different ways. Right. Every way you can think of is how we write.
Do you have any examples, for instance, one of the songs from the record, how that came about?
High Fidelity Man. I just started singing these goofy lyrics and, you know, I was laughing and thought it was really silly. And then that turned into one of the greatest songs. That was a classic cut and paste of nonsensical stuff I was singing. Okay.
much like your studio is exactly how our house is, where we're writing, you know.
Right.
So we have, you know, we have the mic set up. She's sitting on the couch, and I have a recording desk, and the amps and the guitars and all our instruments are around. So a lot of times we'll be playing, and she'll be improvising at the same time, and I'll be playing a riff, and she'll fit something into it. We do that quite a bit, and sometimes the title track "Walk With Me," the way that was written, is we were sitting on a Saturday, you know, and the television was on, and it was the Women's March on Washington. Mm-hmm. The sound was off. She wasn't really watching it, but I was paying attention. And we were fooling around with this, I don't know, a groove, and we put these chords down, and I got up, and I was thinking about it, and I heard everything in my head. I heard the whole thing. I sat down, I started playing, and I never write the lyrics, or sometimes I write a vocal line, a mm-hmm. melody or something. So she started singing the song. And she's saying, and she does this quite often, where she sings all the lyrics, like, immediately.
Just comes out, yeah.
Yeah, it comes out, and I record it, and I'm saying, "What did you say there?" And she said, "I didn't say anything. I mumbled some, you know,
right,
some words or a pattern or something." So anyways, the song came together in 15 minutes, from start to finish.
That's
every
great.
Lyric.
Yeah.
And then I said, do you realize what you're watching here? You're watching the Women's March on Washington. And you just wrote this song, Walk With
yeah.
Me.
It was like, wow, man.
Subliminal thing? Or
yeah, it didn't even register. You know, it was, I wasn't really paying attention. It was just there and in the background.
Because so, it was such a powerful thing. It was such a powerful day.
And
especially just for women. I mean, for men
for
and
sure.
women, you know, it was an amazing day.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that when, she was watching it, didn't enter into her mind, but it came out.
Right.
It came out in a powerful way.
Hopeless and down. There was a place in my life when I was going nowhere fast. I was on the outs. I took a good look in the mirror. What did I see? No one who cares for me. No one who loves me. 'Cause I didn't revere who I was to be. Who I was to be.
I should back up a little bit and let our audience know that in addition to being musical collaborators, you're married.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And how long have you been married?
How long, George? When's our anniversary?
It's in November, dear.
What day? What year?
You're going to put me on the spot.
He has to check his.
Oh, we get. We laugh. It will be, we'll be married 2 years.
Yeah, in about a month.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
Can I ask how you met?
That's real funny because, you know, social media. I mean, I got to tell the truth, right? I'm an honest person. So I saw Laura had was playing a gig in Detroit, and she was advertising this gig.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw her name, and I saw a video of her singing because she made a video of her singing. And I said, well, who is this woman? She can sing.
Right.
Like, really sing. And, I, you know, I've played with a lot of great singers, Thornetta Davis and Robert Gordon and Geneva Magnus. And I heard Laura, and I thought, I was like, wow, she can really sing. So, you know, I was like, who are her friends? And there, she knew all these Detroit musicians as well as Los Angeles musicians.
Okay.
So I didn't know where she was from. I was like, do I know her from L.A.? Do I know her from Detroit? I've never met this woman. So one thing led to another, and I was telling her, I want to come down and see a play. Next thing I knew is her piano player canceled, and she wanted me to play guitar on the gig.
The piano player canceled while you were messaging me and telling me that you had a sitter and you were coming to the show. I said, yeah. Great.
Perfect.
I said, because you know what? I'm going to pay you. Bring your guitar.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Couldn't have worked out better.
Right.
And the keyboard player actually married another girlfriend of mine who's a singer. So it was kind of strange.
Yeah.
So wow. That's how we met. And then we played this gig together. And she was saying, well, you know, I just moved back from Los Angeles to Detroit. And I said, so did I, you know. And she said, I want to start a band. And I said, what kind of band? You know, she said, a blues band. And I said, well, really? I've got experience with that. And you know, what really got me my foot in the door with Laura was I said, I have a PA and a recording set up. So I can make a record.
I'm a producer, baby.
I'm a producer.
<You know?
laughs> I'm going to make you a star.
You scored, Laura, right?
That was really, I mean, yeah, that was it, you know.
And the rest is history.
Right? Yeah. The rest is history. We started writing a week after we met.
So there was a connection right away. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we went straight into writing and gigging. And, the thing that was funny about it is that I recognized right away, as a musician, I could hear where she was coming from with her music. And sometimes when you're your own person, you may not know. You may not know how do I appear to the rest of the world? You know,
right.
So I could hear right away that she was a soul singer, an R&B singer, and a blues singer. You could hear the R&B and gospel, and you could hear Detroit in her voice. She grew up, you know, in the Detroit area. So I could hear that right away, and I could tell right away, you need a certain style of composition behind you, you know. And so that was the other thing is that she's very creative and unique. And so when we started writing, it came out. In a weird way, you know, my sense of music and hers together.
So you're the Ike to her Tina, I may.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
Well, you know, I've known a lot of couples professionally in the business world, let's say, that work together and they were married. And sometimes I think it can be a good thing and sometimes I think it can be a bad thing. But the fact that you guys collaborate and are working sort of for the same goal, not for like two different departments, not for accounting and
right.
HR or something. I mean, how does that work? You guys are probably together 24/7.
We are. And well, for me, at least creatively, you know, when I was writing my own material and trying to sing my own material, I was never satisfied.
So you always have a partner, a writing partner, and
yeah,
a collaborator.
Yeah, and it was like being a bird with not being able to fly.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I can say is that. And then when I met her, all of a sudden it was like, the songs are flying now.
That's great.
And the everything we write has life.
This is true.
You know, instead of writing, I think for a lot of writers too, is they write and the song sits.
Because they're never sure what to do with
it. Right,
and
they may not even perform.
Right.
You know, and a lot of performers are, they don't write because they perform.
So you're almost challenging each other a little bit in some ways?
Yeah, well, we have, you know, obviously, she's a performer for sure.
Right.
Laura, you know, when she sings, that's the thing. Just like if you saw Otis Redding sing, that's the, you know, the performance of his song is it.
Right.
Right. She's the same kind of singer, is that it's an emotional performance and it's happening in real time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but she's also very creative. So that's what I mean is like, I got lucky in that when we write, the songs are they're natural, they're evolving, and they're being created in the moment, and so they become vehicles for her to perform, do her thing.
Great.
Yeah.
Back to the record. I mean, I definitely hear Detroit. I hear Memphis. I even hear some, you know, Paisley Park. I mean, to me, it sounds like a 60s, 70s R&B soul record. I mean, so as far as production, I mean, was that the plan to kind of accomplish that sound, to get that vibe?
Well, every album is like a work of art, a series of a work of art, you know, and there's a commonality through the album, even though they don't necessarily seem like they would fit, but they all do. They're all pieces of this puzzle. And for some reason, the vision of the album was 70s soul and the 60s hard driving, you know, stomper. We always have a rocker in there, and we have a killer blues tune on this record, which we're really proud of. So the theme, I don't know if it was initiated to be as such, but it definitely is projected as that, and it's a complete idea, and it does come to life as that.
What's the blues number that you're referencing?
Learning the hard way.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Mm-hmm. I always say playing to lose. I say the wrong song title.
I do the
playing
same
to
thing.
Lose. I say, what?
We tell the band on stage a lot of time, hey, we're going to play playing to lose. Like, what song is that?
I always do the first line of the song, even
right.
if it's not the title.
Right.
You know?
I used to have a bass player that would say, I would give him all the wrong names to the songs because he would do the same thing and we understood each other.
Right. Just as long as you give him the right key. We'll
right.
Be okay.
Right.
That was sometimes a problem, but.
But, you know, the 70s, 60s, you know, as far as tone,
mm-hmm.
which I think is, you know, important, really important to, I mean, you know, capturing a band live, that's one dimension of it. And then the other dimension is, you know, in 70s soul, are the drums, they don't sound like they're in some huge room or
right.
something.
Right.
They're dry.
Yeah.
You know, like an Al Green record. Like they're in this tiny little studio with burlap all over it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know? we definitely do that to evoke. Because they're audio triggers that you would associate with a style of
right.
music, you know?
Yeah, you hear those horns, and like that's right, Memphis, right? You hear,
mm-hmm.
you hear the stacks
yeah.
or the high, you know, record sound. You know?
Yeah, for sure. And but you know, it's we recorded in this big room, so sometimes things are more it's not like you're going for the perfect sound to try to make the perfect 70s masterpiece. What I'm saying is, but yes, that we're always paying attention to the tone of the presentation, you know.
Well, also, you know, we are not trying to recreate anything. It just happens that I have an affinity for many of my influences of 70s soul, of Memphis soul, of some guttural, you know, Buddy Guy blues, you know, Bobby Bland style. Mm-hmm. Everything we do is fresh and original, but we definitely pay homage to our icons, you know, that inspire us. And it's not on purpose. It's just kind of a natural thing that happens when we're recording, because we want to do the song justice in the style that it should be done.
And it just comes naturally. I mean, I've heard people talk about particular artists and sounds like this person, sounds like that person. But you come to find out that maybe they were their influences. So, I mean, Laura, who would be some of your influences in addition to Buddy and Bobby Bland? And
well, Al Green, for sure. You know, Chaka Khan was one of my big influences. Patti LaBelle, Aretha Franklin. You know, even Janis Joplin in the beginning when I was, you know, young listening. I think her performance, her emotion, not her voice mm-hmm. as much, but her emotional performance. And I think that's what I really latched onto is the emotion cutting through the song. Am I feeling it as if somebody is reaching out to me?
Right.
So those types of singers and performers, regardless of the genre.
Yeah.
Are what inspire me.
Just people who have feeling, soul. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When did you start singing?
You know, I think it was inside of me. Music was always inside of me. Ever since I was little, I knew that I wanted to be a singer. I was writing songs, you know, when I was 7 years old. I was just doing it. Nobody told me to do
That's
it.
That's who you were. Yeah.
And then I had really not, oh, well, I can't be this or I can't be that. And I don't think I owned up to the responsibility of what was given to me, because I really, it was something inside me. I didn't create it. It was a gift.
Right.
Really didn't understand it and appreciate it and give it justice until I really decided that this is what I'm going to do. And, none of this other jobs and different things. I'm going to live for what this is inside
what
of me and try to bring this gift out mm-hmm. because it is a gift. And ever since I decided to do that, which you have to jump through a lot of fear to really get mm-hmm. to the other side of just making that commitment, when I met George shortly before, I said, you know what? We're going to do this now. I can always do this, and this later. We're going to do this now. And I really took a leap of faith, and things just kind of lined up as if, you know, I would make a decision, then this would come to me. I would make a decision, then this would come to me. So I knew I was doing the right thing. I was getting signs that I was doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think of those moments when that happens, and it can be very difficult what we do on the road. And a lot of letdowns and disappointment, but you have to find the moments and almost the divine times when you know you're on the right path and doing what you're doing. Those things and the people that you meet along the way, those glimmers of light and hope and encouragement, and people that want to shine light on your music and your art and your creativity, that's what keeps you going. And that's the most important thing, because you know you're on the right path.
Well, I've heard people talk about you know, the 3 hours on stage are the when you're in the zone and it's the magical time, it's the other 21 hours that are difficult to deal with, you know.
It's true. A lot of musicians always joke is that that's what they get paid for, to load the van and unload the van and drive
long
3
drives,
hours.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's not... No,
it's a means to an end, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think there's a musician alive who thinks being on stage is the job, you know?
Because it's performing. Also... And it's also being in your living room and creating songs and...
It's a lot. That's a lot of work in itself. And, yeah, booking the gigs and talking. And, I mean, it's exhausting. Laura works, 10, 12 hours every day of the week.
Sometimes with no results for weeks, it can really be discouraging.
Frustrating. Yeah. So you get the gig and you make it on stage. Can you talk about performing?
Most exhilarating factor in the performance is when you know that you've moved somebody and you've changed their perception, you know, for that hour or 90 minutes or 2 hours. You've kind of transformed this certain space for them and really transported them, and they're feeling what you're giving them. And that's what it's all about. It's about the people and the connection and the transfer of emotion and energy. And when they're receiving that, it's really powerful. So when you've done that, and it doesn't happen all the time,
sure,
the way that you would want to happen, but when that happens, it's incredibly powerful.
George, can you tell me a little bit about your background and your origins in music?
I think I told you I grew up in Upper Michigan, the Upper Peninsula in Marquette, Michigan. This is a small college town, the largest town in the UP. On Lake Superior. And I grew up, I saw a lot of concerts because it's a college town. Mm-hmm. So there was people coming through, there was musicians in town. And my father was from Detroit and had a huge record collection. He graduated high school in the late 50s. So he had Chess records, 45s, you know. He had a ton of R&B 45s and rock and early rock and roll and things like that. So I grew up listening to music, and then my parents were both teachers. So when I started playing guitar and playing music, and I was supported.
Right.
You know, it was
that's important.
They were very supportive. And I didn't really realize that I would be a musician, but I studied. I had lessons. I went to jazz camp in the summers when I was in high school.
That sounds like fun. Jazz
camp. For sure. So I got I was supported and encouraged, you know. Nobody ever taught me how to be a musician, how to survive.
Right.
You know. Make a living until I was much later into my 20s, you know. But I was always supported to be creative, you know. And so I just kept going and kept playing gigs and being in different bands. And eventually, I made it so where I was making money playing gigs, you know,
right,
in Detroit. At the time, and I was I'm studying jazz at Wayne State University, and I got to back Johnny Adams.
Cool.
Yeah, I played in an R&B, you know, huge band called the Sun Messengers, and I don't know. I just as soon as I started playing that music, and making money from it, and I had a class from John Sinclair. Who was the old manager of the MC5.
Okay.
And he taught a class at the university called The History of Rock and Roll, which started in the 19th century, his class.
Wow.
And ended in about 1960, 61. Right. That's where he ended the class. So I learned a lot about music from him. And all those records that I heard from my father, I was able to put into some perspective.
Make that connection.
Yeah. And especially with studying jazz and the guitar and thinking about where the instrument, how did Wes Montgomery sound like he did, and this sure. person and that person. It all made sense to me after that class. And so that's really where it all came into my head, and making money and being able to survive playing my instrument. And then I was totally off after that.
And so professionally, you've worked with, you mentioned Robert Gordon.
Yeah. I was, at the time, in my late 20s, I was playing, blues, a lot of blues, mm-hmm. a lot of rockabilly, funk, soul, just gigging and playing and learning as much as I could. And a friend in Detroit brought Robert Gordon in to play in Detroit. And my band at the time, the Twist and Tarantulas, we backed him, right? And he loved us, because we were fresh and we had an upright bass, and he hadn't had an upright bass on stage since, I don't know, 1979 or something, so he really liked the energy of the newer rockabilly people. Because he grew up doing, or when he was popular, doing rockabilly in the 70s and sure. 80s. It was different. He was like the wave with the Stray Cats.
Yeah, people wanted to call him punk rock because it was the time, and he had cool hair, but he was right. really a rockabilly guy.
And he had the voice to really do it, So that's why I got... he loved the band, so we toured with him quite a bit. And then later, I had my own band, and we toured Finland and Sweden and Norway. We played in Los Angeles, Chicago, New York City. We played all over the world with him, and that was a really interesting time. And I later moved to Los Angeles, and I met Geneva Magnus there. Mm-hmm. I got to play guitar with her for 4 years or something. I traveled the world with her, when I lived in Detroit, I played with Thornetta Davis mm-hmm. there. That she is a magical singer,
right?
So I've been fortunate to play with a lot of different artists, that are where the guitar is an important part of the right. show, which is a big challenge because you're in the hot seat,
But that was good training to prepare you to work with Laura.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
Listening to the record, your new record, the thought occurred to me a few years back. I was in Tampa and somebody said, go to this place and see a blues band. And there was they were a fine band, but one person I recognized, and I went up to him, I said, you're from Chicago, aren't you? He said, yeah, how did you know? And he just had that thing. So listening to your record, I hear Detroit. I mean, I don't know how to explain it, but could you talk about how Detroit and being from Detroit, and living in Detroit, has impacted your music?
Hmm.
Well, we don't... I think we know that we do have that indescribable Detroit thing,
mm-hmm.
And we do brand our music as such, but it's kind of a natural thing. And I always liken it to the sound of the machines. When you grow up in a factory town and your family works on the assembly line and you're inside the plants and the machines. I used to always go inside the GM plant, the Poletown plant in Hamtramck, and the buttons and the conveyor belts and the machines. And then you see the murals of the men working on the trains. there's like a rhythm in itself to that industrial time, and when things were great, seemingly great in the U.S. and in the Rust Belt cities, it was thriving. And, you know, that essence, that work ethic, that Midwest work ethic, I think it all kind of comes together. And I think the Motown sound specifically came from a lot of people and families coming up from the South,
sure,
to work for the auto companies. So there's something unique about that pilgrimage from the South to Detroit, a little bit different than New York City, a little bit different than Chicago,
right,
a little bit different than Baltimore. It's just kind of an inexplicable sound. Baltimore has their own sound, you know, Chicago has their own sound, and we have ours. And as far as I can feel it, that's where it all must come from. You know, these different influences coming together in an industrial booming city at the time makes that certain sound.
There's a wide variety of music from Detroit. It's there's a lot to think about there.
Yeah.
Right.
For sure. And in blues, nowhere near as well known as Chicago.
Yeah.
And the amount of artists that played that Mississippi
John
blues.
Lee Hooker.
John Lee, right, Hooker was, right, there. He didn't sound like any of those guys in Chicago.
Right.
You know, I should also say that, all those artists were unique in their own. Jimmy Reed didn't sound like those guys either.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of music there. But really, when I think of Detroit, I think Laura's right. There's this rhythmic thing that's going on. But there's also gospel. There's for sure that influenced everything. The gospel singers, the organ, you know, the tambourine. If you think about just that in itself,
right,
is to me like the hugest impact that it had on all of the music,
sure,
that came out of there. But then out of that music, I was reading the other day, you know, in the early 60s, there was 90 record labels in Detroit.
Talk about booming industry and
booming,
you know, everybody and working and, yeah,
right,
thriving.
Around the time when Berry Gordy started and was starting to gain steam in Motown, he had a lot of competition, you know, a lot of competition. All R&B soul gospel records, you know. There's a conference coming up in a couple weeks, which is, a Northern Soul conference, where these guys from London are coming over for the weekend and hosting a huge conference with a record convention, artist performances, you know. So Detroit was always that city for R&B and soul music. And then, which influenced, you know, the next thing, which was Mitch Ryder, you know, even Bob Seger.
Right.
You know, people think, oh, Bob Seger. They think of all sorts of things.
But great catalog, great singer.
Great singer, and for sure a singer schooled in, a presentation like a Wilson Pickett or a Otis Redding, you know. So the Memphis sound, not very close to the Detroit thing, soul and R&B. And there was a connection there, too, where, Isaac Hayes was doing stuff in Detroit. Aretha, of course, recorded, mm-hmm, all that stuff in New York and down south.
Sure.
But lived in Detroit.
And had the church experience in Detroit.
Exactly. Yeah. And her father, C.L. Franklin, that church and Jackie Wilson, all these people, the more, when you read about it, you know, they're all connected. Berry Gordy and Jackie Wilson were, even though Jackie Wilson wasn't on Motown records, you know. So Detroit's a city of singers, for sure. as opposed to Chicago, which is different.
There's more just, guitar slingers or harmonica players as well as singers.
Yeah, just a totally different thing, you know. Which you know, and then the Stooges and the MC5 mm-hmm. and now, you know, the White Stripes and Kid Rock and Eminem, these are like, and lots of rap music, techno music is a huge thing in Detroit. Huge, you know, million selling techno artists. They have a big electronic festival there. It's a magical place for music. There's a lot of music created there.
Going back to the record, the production of the record, did you have to do anything different to try to get some of those sounds that are as opposed to just what the band sounds like playing live? I mean, Technologic is a producer or as a singer, did you have to do some different things to try to get that sound?
A little bit. The biggest thing was making the band play together and getting the tempos right and minimal miking on the drums. That really helps. Trying to capture the emotion, I think we said before we were talking, you were asking we were saying how, you know, a lot of bands go into the studio and they go into a great studio, an expensive one, and cut 8 tunes in a day.
Right.
You know, there's nothing
looking
wrong
at
with
the clock.
That. Right. Looking at the clock. But there's nothing wrong with that. But we took our time, you know, we would record 3 to 5 songs in a day. And we ended up recording about 18 or something. So we would move mics around. We used an Oberheim synthesizer, a real one. You know, we didn't change the instruments out so much as move mics and try to get the band to perform the song so everybody felt like they were getting the emotion across, you know. That was really the biggest thing. Some of them were very hard to capture the right tempo and the right groove, you know.
Do you find yourself slowing the tempo down or speeding it up? I mean, to get it right. It depends on the song, but so many bands, I think, perform so fast. And you get in the studio, it's like, let's just take a deep breath and let's find the right tempo. Especially as a singer, you don't want to have to push it and you know, try to keep up with the band. It's not a race, right?
That's right. It's not a race.
Right. We pay close attention, you know, because what really helps us is when we demo the songs at home is just we experiment with different tempos before we even show the tune to the band.
Right.
You know, and as soon as the band starts playing it, they're like all over the map. You know, because now it's pure emotion.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, well, this feels cool. I'm like, well, what if you back it down?
Yeah, let's rein it in a little bit.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think, you know, when you when you listen to High Records and you listen to Syl Johnson or Al Green or Ann Peebles or something, those tempos come natural to some people.
Right.
And to others, they don't come naturally, you know. And you would be very surprised if you sat down with a metronome and you know, tapped out those tempos, because it'll teach you a lesson.
Right.
It'll school you.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, that's I think more so getting tempo and arrangement and capturing a great performance of a song was really important.
Where can people find out about the band and where to get the record and where you're playing?
The best way is on our website, laurarain.net. The best way to get our album or our vinyl is to come to a show. Everybody needs to come out to a show.
Support live music.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I can mail one to you, sure, but you need to come to the show. You know, we are also on social media, of course, Facebook and Twitter. But please come out and get off the couch and support a show. I know it gets harder and harder, you know, for everybody to come out, and but we certainly appreciate it.
Okay, what do you say we get the band up here and make some music?
Sounds great. Let's do it.
Ready, Mr. Jones? Yeah. 1, 2, 3.
Decision, and it's a wrong game. Too many bad.
was fun.